Hi, welcome back to AR Zone. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. These continuing interviews on intersectional veganism and related issues are in association with VegFest UK. Roger and I are joined today by our special guest, Laura Slifer. Laura is a pro-intersectional vegan. She's a writer, a theatre artist, and educator whose work has spanned the globe from the Middle East to China and beyond. Laura has been working on a book for vegan publishers, Liberating Veganism, which deals with animal rights psychology and philosophy, and she regularly speaks about intersecting human and other animal liberation issues. Laura is speaking at VegFest Brighton's Pro-Intersectionality Summit this weekend. Laura, thanks for joining us today, and welcome back to our intersectionality series.
Thank you so much for having me again.
You are so welcome. Laura, as I just mentioned in the intro, you'll be speaking at VegFest in Brighton on the south coast of England this weekend, and your talk sounds absolutely fascinating. Would you please tell us a little bit about it and why it's so important to you?
Okay. Well, basically, so the theme of the conference actually is all of us were supposed to come up with a response to this question of what's happening in the political climate right now with kind of the breakdown of neoliberalism, which has been kind of the dominating political and economic ideology and policy and influence, certainly throughout my lifetime, and that is finally collapsing at this time. And in its wake, we're seeing this rise of white nationalism. We're seeing this rise of neo-fascism. And really, you know, how can we respond to that? How can we respond to that, not just as individuals, but as a movement, as an animal liberation movement? How is that connected, and how will that affect our movement, and all that sort of stuff? So it was very interesting because at the time when I was approached to do VegFest, I was really thinking about these issues, not in terms specifically about the animal liberation movement, but just in general. And I was really feeling like, you know, they talk about how when there's a crisis, it kind of opens up a space. And you see this all throughout history. But, you know, certainly if you look at like the 20th century, you'll see this a lot, that, you know, there's a crisis, it opens up a space that can go one way or the other. And, you know, when there's like a big economic collapse, which is really what happened in 2008 that we're still feeling the reverberations from, that opened up the space of, is it going to go to the left or is it going to go to the right? You know, capitalism is obviously in crisis. Here is, if you know what to do with it, an opportunity for building something new. And so I was really deeply looking into kind of all these different philosophies and ideas about how to build a new society. And along the way, I came across Peter Kropotkin, who is the founder of what is called anarcho-communism. So it's actually a combination of anarchism and communism. Obviously, there's a lot of misunderstanding about those two terms, but basically what it means is a society that is structured where there is no hierarchy. So when I say no hierarchy, I mean there's no institutionalized hierarchy. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, there might be someone, for example, that like in indigenous cultures, you know, there was a lot of confusion with white colonizers, European colonizers, where they thought that there was a hierarchy. In Native American cultures, where it turned out that there was somebody that was sort of like a guide or an advisor that they thought was a chief. But no hierarchy actually means that there's no one that is in an official position above anyone else. So maybe somebody, you know, becomes, you know, a sort of guide because everybody likes to turn to them for wisdom, but they're not in any sort of official position of power. So no hierarchy. And the other aspect to it is shared, collectivized resources, that basically everybody is living in a way where they are, you know, taking only what they need and sharing. So when you combine those two things, you know, the no hierarchy with the socialism or communism, you get a very interesting connection, because basically people, when they hear communism or socialism, they think authoritarianism. They think somebody's going to come and take your resources, take your private property. But of course, there's no hierarchy. So who would be in that position to do that? No one. It's actually the most directly democratic form of system at all, because everything is done collectively, that the group has to make a decision, and everything is directly democratic. There's no hierarchy. So I was looking into all of that, you know, kind of separately from my work as an animal liberationist. And then I came across Peter Kropotkin, and I discovered that actually he had come up with these ideas about how to structure the society from observing animal societies. This was actually in response to Darwin. If you're familiar at all with Darwinism, you know, Darwin had this whole idea of the survival of the fittest and natural selection, and that, you know, only those with the quote unquote best traits would be the ones that would survive, and everybody else would kind of fall to the wayside. This was how he viewed animal societies in this very sort of ruthless way. And actually, Darwin's ideas led to a lot of horrifyingly, I mean, this is the understatement of the millennium to say that they led to horrifyingly nefarious social influences and social policies. You know, there's literally a term for it, social Darwinism. And this led to everything from absolute ruthlessness in terms of anybody that was vulnerable in any way, you know, just leaving them to die, you know, certainly anyone who was poor, anyone who was disabled, all these sorts of things, and horrifying racism, you know, this idea of, oh, you know, there's one race that is genetically superior to the others, so we want to, you know, promote the breeding of this race, and we want to, you know, basically get rid of the others. I mean, it led to the Holocaust. It was led to the eugenics movement. It led to, I mean, it led to horrible, horrible, horrible things. So Kropotkin was around at the same time, basically, as Darwin. And so he heard about Darwin's ideas, and Darwin's ideas, you know, were kind of the rage at that time. Then Kropotkin, and basically there was another, he was a zoologist named Kessler, and he discovered, he said, that when he observed animal societies, that's not really how it worked, he said that actually animal societies were really kind of the opposite of that, in terms of the fact that everybody looked out for each other, everyone took care of each other, you know, they shared, they cooperated. So Kropotkin became very fascinated with this, and he went and he did years of research out in northern Russia and northern Asia and Siberia, actually, he was based in. What he saw was that Kessler, who really didn't get a chance to develop his theories very much because he actually died a year after, came out with this. But Kropotkin kind of took that further, and he said, you know, I observed species from insects to crabs to birds to deer to, I mean, all sorts of different species. And he said the patterns were the same again and again and again, that you saw great, you know, caring, cooperation, you know, wasn't survival of the fittest at all. In fact, he said, actually, you know, this whole idea of, oh, the smartest will survive or the strongest will survive. He said, no, actually, the ones that survive are the ones that know how to work with others. They're the ones that have, if you want to talk about natural selection, if you want to talk about the ones that have the strongest survival skills, it's actually the animals that know how to work with others, collaborate with others, share with others. He said, you know, and basically the most unforgivable sin in an animal society is being greedy, you know, is not working with the community. And, you know, he said that was actually, you know, basically, I mean, if you're talking about this in human terms, you know, it's kind of the proverbial 1% that want everything for themselves. They were the ones that, you know, the rest of the animals really kind of turned against, he said. But as long as everybody was working together, you know, it was all good. And he said something else that I found very interesting was that he said it's not survival of the fittest, And it's not ruthless, but it's also not charity either. Because, you know, there is, you know, another way of interpreting this of, you know, oh, this is sympathy or, you know, it's like charity, you know, that the strong kind of take care of the weak. He said, no, he said, actually, this is a survival instinct that is driving them to do this. But it's not, you know, it's not a survival instinct in the way of survival of the fittest, but survival instinct in the way of them knowing that, you know, everyone's survival in that community, including their own, is dependent on the community being strong. That if, you know, they tried to do things, you know, on their own where they were going to kind of go against the community and just do what they wanted, that would actually, they couldn't survive on their own. There was no way that they could survive on their own. So it was basically, it's not charity, it's solidarity. And there's this great Australian Aboriginal saying, actually, that I think really relates to this a lot. It made me think of it as I was reading it, of, you know, if you come to help me and, you know, you're an ally, you know, you're coming to help me, then leave me alone. You know, don't even bother. But if your liberation, your own liberation, your own freedom is tied up in mine, then let us work together. That was very much the sort of scenario that he was describing among non-human societies, that they knew that their own survival was dependent on working together and looking out for one another. So I was like, and basically that is how he built his whole idea of how to construct a human society was based on animal societies. So I thought, my God, this is so unbelievably fascinating and important for us to know about, you know, for us to know about right now on the whole, because we do need a new direction in human society, certainly in, you know, Western society. But also I said to myself, my God, you know, as animal liberationists, this is really important. And we ourselves have not been recognizing that actually we have a lot to learn from them. You know, I guess you could call that speciesism in some ways. But, you know, we have so much that we can learn from them. Instead of saying, you know, we're the voice for the voiceless, we need to be listening to their voices. We need to be seeing their ways of doing things. And we need to be learning from them. We need to be learning from them about how to also organize our own movement, how to listen to each other, how to support one another. Something that I am going to bring up in the talk that I really have been so amazed by is how I'm seeing this play out in the pro-intersectional side to the animal liberation movement of us supporting each other, listening to each other, you know, working collaboratively. I'm seeing that play out, and it's a really beautiful thing. And, you know, it is really something that I think is reflective of non-human values.
Laura, it's also fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Laura, Roger here. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Very good. So how many hours has Sebastian given you for your talk at VegFest?
I know, there's a lot to say about the subject, I know.
Yeah, so anyway, welcome back to AR's own pro-intersectionality. I think you're on more than Carolyn at the moment, so welcome back anyway. So I've got a kind of movement question wrapped up in politics, really, which is,
yes.
Given kind of political shifts, you know, in recent times, we could say amplifications of trends that have already been there, I guess, could put it that way. And given the welcome focus on intersectionality in the animal movement, as you mentioned, even though it's a bit fragmented, or seems to be at the time, do you think that the animal advocates and the animal movement in a wider sense have grasped how serious things are right now?
I think, you know, of course there are several different influences kind of going on in the movement. As a whole, of course, I would have to say probably not. And I also think that they're not making the connection to what's going on right now in the wider society and how that relates to animal rights, how that relates to our own movement. I don't think they're making those connections at all. And not only that, but how animal rights relates to what's going on in the wider society. I mean, it goes both ways. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think that some people, are concerned about what's going on with the horrifying bigotry, you know, with the white nationalism, with the neo-fascism, but they're, again, they're not kind of making those connections. Also with war, that's something that's really not being spoken about in the movement at all, which concerns me. Even in the pro-intersectional side, we're not really having those conversations, and we need to be. And that is something that I need to really be pushing on, because that's something you've spoken about a lot, Roger, and I really appreciate that. Trump is saying now that he wants to increase military spending by 10%. That may not sound like a lot to people who don't know how much the U.S. already spends and how much we're already militarily involved, but we already spend more than the next 17 biggest spenders combined. We also have been bombing 7 countries over the course of actually the last 8 years over the Obama presidency, and he wants to ramp up military action even more. So that's something that I feel is not, you know, you always talk about, Roger, you always talk about veganism being very tied in with the peace movement. You always talk about how, you know, really Donald Watson kind of created the philosophy of veganism, saying, of course, the Western philosophy of veganism. But, you know, in terms of that he, you know, that really was kind of something that was a response to the horrors of World War One and then World War Two, and that this was something that we could directly do refuse participation in violence. And I don't feel like that conversation is being had at all. Actually, I just recently saw a video from the Women's March that was like a promotional video. This was their official promotional video. And right in the middle of it, they had this big sign that was saying, "Oh, NATO, please help us," as if this would be a good thing. And I shared it in some vegan spaces because I was very concerned about it. You know, people weren't really seeing that. And I was thinking, wow, this is something we need to be talking about a lot more, is war and imperialism, because that conversation is not being had. So, you know, I think in terms of taking it seriously and realizing the ramifications of it, you know, we've got basically three different sort of elements in the movement. And one is, of course, the pro-intersectional side of the movement. And that is very, I think they're taking it very seriously. I think that there are some connections being made to what's going on in the bigger society and what is going on in our own movement, some of the patterns that we're seeing in our own movement of oppressive attitudes and behaviors. And I think that, you know, there's a general concern about that. And I think also that a lot of us feel, and I very much feel, that some of the most important work that we can be doing against bigotry actually is within our own movement. Unfortunately, there is so much bigotry being expressed within our own movement that that is some of the most important work that we can be doing to counteract bigotry, is speaking to our own community of the animal rights movement, vegan movement, etc. I would say that, you know, on the flip side, of course, we've got people that are expressing a lot of bigotry within the movement. It, you know, it's very interesting because with Trump, for example, some of the tactics that he uses actually are some of the tactics that we have seen in the mainstream animal rights movement. You know, I'm just going to name names here. I mean, there's definitely something to be said, and I'm not the only one who said this. Other people have said this as well. But I mean, there's definitely kind of a similarity in the way that Trump conducts himself in a lot of ways, and in the way that PETA conducts itself in many ways. You know, they're really kind of trying to be controversial, trying to create a media spectacle, and they will, you know, attack and exploit and throw anyone under the bus that can help them in that aim. And he does the exact same thing. And of course, as we saw, you know, PETA even took, I mean, I talked about this on Animal Rights Zone. PETA even took Trump's words and, you know, about women and how he felt entitled to sexually assault women. And, you know, they took those words and they made a joke out of it. So there's some people in the movement that I wouldn't even say that it's that they don't take it seriously. I would say that actually they support it in some ways of what's going on. I mean, you even mentioned there's like a Facebook group now, Vegans for Trump. This is really disgraceful as far as I'm concerned, because no other social justice movement would have that element to it the way that there is in this one. And that's a really very, very disturbing thing. So, and then you also have, you know, some people in the animal rights movement that are what I would call species utilitarians, even if they don't know that term for it, where they're kind of using this idea of, well, humanity is just such a mess anyway that we should all basically be exterminated except for the vegans. But everybody else can go to hell. Everybody else can die because, after all, our existence is causing problems for the animals and causing their suffering and causing their death and causing their extinction in a lot of cases. So to hell with all of you people that are oppressed, to hell with all of you people that are marginalized. You know, if Trump drops a bomb, that'll be a good thing because, after all, there are all these people that, you know, eat meat in that country. So, I mean, there's just really like a lot of very, very disturbing attitudes going around. And then, of course, you've got the mainstream sort of big middle population there. And, you know, they're not the two extremes. Well, I'm saying pro-intersectional liberationists are not extreme in a bad way, but uncompromising is the word I would use. But, you know, then you've got this middle group that kind of, you know, they're just more excited about the Beyond Burgers coming out and new vegan soap. And, you know, they're very consumerist and, dare I say it, very privileged for the most part. And they're just really kind of out of touch with the reality. They may hear about these things and think that they're disturbing or terrible, but it doesn't affect them on a personal level. And they don't see how it could possibly connect with animal liberation. So that's basically kind of the dynamic that I'm seeing in response to this.
Yep, I think your analysis is accurate, I think.
Yeah,
I agree.
I wish it was. I wish I was way off base and you'd be like, Laura, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. But I would get angry if you said that because I know that it is true. yeah, it's pretty disturbing, a lot of it, honestly.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said as well, Laura. It can be a little bit depressing, but it's the way it is. Laura, I want to thank you very much for making time to speak with us today. I want to wish you luck for your talk on the weekend.
Thank you.
Even though I've said this before, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for everything that you're doing. I think your work is incredibly valuable. Thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on again. I really always appreciate that so much.
Yeah, good luck at the weekend, Laura.
Thank you.
This is maturity. Now a member of the animal kingdom. Ever did a thing to me. So I don't need red meat or white.